I'd like to thank the organisers for putting together this workshop and giving me the opportunity to be here. So in my talk today, I'll show results of inelastic neutron scattering experiments and also heat capacity data to explore the phase diagram and spin dynamics in the turbine titanate pyroflow that we've already heard about in the earlier talks this morning. So this material has been explored by a number of groups already, and we're going to hear some more talks even this afternoon. So one of the outstanding issues in the field is to understand how the spin dynamics evolves with magnetic field. In particular, at high field, one observes very sharp dispersive modes as associated with coherent magnons. However, at zero field, the spectrum is dominated by a very broad continuum of excitations. Despite the fact that the system shows well-developed ferromagnetic magnetic order in some canted fashion here. So I'm going to show experiments in magnetic field applied along a cubic axis. This is different from previous studies, and we're going to argue that this allows for a much simpler phase diagram and somewhat more transparent interpretation of the results. So the main players for this work have been two former alumni from the University of Waterloo here. So Jordan Thompson, who used to be an undergraduate here and did his PhD in Oxford in my group, and Paul McClarty did all the spin wave calculation and refinement of the Hamiltonian parameters, and he is a postdoc alumni from here. Our single crystal was grown by Prabhakaran in Oxford, and we did all the inelastic neutron scattering experiments at the Pulse Neutron Source in the UK, together with Ivelisse Cabrera and Tatiana Guidi. So we've already heard in the introductory talks this morning that the pyroclore lattice of a corner-shared tetrahedra can host a very rich physics depending on the type of Hamiltonian that leads to interactions between neighboring spins. And in the case of very strong easy axis anisotropy, that forces the spins to point in or out of the center of the tetrahedron, as in the case of holmium and dysprosium titanate, one observes a classical spin liquid, classical spin ice with extensive ground state degeneracy and characteristic signatures in the elastic diffuse scattering. And in the presence of some additional perturbations around this limit, there are theoretical proposals for quantum spin ice with coherently propagating magnetic monopoles. Now, the nearest neighbor Hamiltonian actually on this lattice, given symmetry constraints, as we've heard earlier, allows a very strongly anisotropic exchange that's determined by four independent parameters. And if these parameters, if we move away from the classical spin ice point, more generally, one can stabilize different types of ordered phases. And here is a phase diagram that's quite popular to show, illustrating the regions of stability for canted ferromagnetic phase, phase with orthogonal moments, so-called Palmer choker, and also phases where magnetic moments are ordered in the XY planes perpendicular to the local 111 axis. So from a fundamental point of view, it's quite interesting to explore not just the ordering, but also the dynamics of these phases, because the Hamiltonian is intrinsically quantum. And there are various materials that have been explored so far and put on this phase diagram. So ytterbium titanate stands out in this respect. It shows a fundamental puzzle that has been illustrated by previous experiments, that at high magnetic fields, it displays sharp magnons, whereas in zero field, only broad scattering was reported. Okay? So one might be interested to answer the question how these two apparently very distinct limits evolve if we vary the field. Okay? And if one attributes this broad continuum scattering in zero field to the presence of some very strong quantum fluctuations, How do these fluctuations evolve with increasing magnetic field? Are they suppressed gradually, or is there a sharp phase transition above which we have no quantum fluctuations? What's the manifestation of quantum fluctuations at high fields? And this really was the motivation behind our experiments, to experimentally characterize how the spectrum evolves as a function of field, how the quasiparticles evolve between these two apparently very distinct limits. So we've heard also in Tara McQueen's talk earlier this morning that ytterbium titanate can have is very sensitive to the synthesis conditions, and the low temperature behavior is affected by this. So here I'm showing specific heat measurements on our single crystal pictured here, which observe a very sharp transition, single peak in specific heat. This sharp transition is associated with the onset of spontaneous counted ferromagnetic order, as illustrated here. So at the time when we did these experiments, this crystal was one that showed the highest transition temperature, and we've heard recently more progress in this field that increase even higher this transition temperature. The fact that we see a sharp transition indicates to us that we have a well-developed magnetic order, so the behavior is similar to that of the highest purity samples. So the strategy that we've adopted experimentally is to start from very high fields where magnetization is almost saturated, spins are polarized by the field in directions that minimize the local G tensor. And so here we expect to have well-developed magnon excitations that essentially originate from flipping a spin on one of the four sublattices of the pyrochore lattice, so in each of the corners of the primary tetrahedron. And that's indeed what we see experimentally. We can observe clearly four modes at each wave vector Q, and the dispersion relations and the intensity and various gaps that come into the spectrum are a direct reflection of the exchange Hamiltonian. And with increasing field, the spectrum moves to higher field due to the increase in Zeeman energy. So as I mentioned before, the particular form of the dispersions, gaps, intensities, and so on carry information about the underlying exchange Hamiltonian. And we've heard earlier that symmetry constraints at the nearest neighbor level the Hamiltonian to have four independent exchange parameters. This is the Ising part, and the other ones are some transverse exchange terms. And also, we have a G tensor with two terms, perpendicular and longitudinal, along the local threefold axis. So it's important to appreciate that the spin wave spectrum actually depends on all of these six parameters. And all the six parameters are very strongly coupled to one another, in a sense that the equilibrium spin direction is not along one of the quantization axes, but actually tilted away from it. And if we vary every single term in the Hamiltonian, the orientation direction of the effective spins will tilt ever so slightly, and then the projection of the Hamiltonian into the new quantization axis will vary, and so the dispersions will vary. So this is a very strongly coupled problem, and one needs a lot of qualitatively distinct pieces of information in order to decouple this. And in particular, at high fields, the Ising part of the exchange and the longitudinal part of the G factor are very strong, have very similar effects, because the exchange part acts as a mean field along the longitudinal direction. So in order to find a unique solution for the Hamiltonian, we used our own experimental data set with field along a cubic axis, and we looked at very many directions in reciprocal space, not just along symmetry directions, but also off-symmetry axes, because these contain, in fact, even more information about the Hamiltonian. We also used the previous experimental data set from Bruce Gorland's group with field along a different direction. So this has the advantage that we look at two different projections of the same Hamiltonian onto different axes. And in addition to this, we also used the value of the magnetization and saturation. And this imposes an additional constraint on the absolute magnitude of the G-tensor. So using all of these constraints, we're able to find a unique solution for the Hamiltonian, where we refine all of the exchange parameters and the two G-tensor parameters. We also, using this technique, we find that we break up the correlation between the exchange parameters and the G-tensor. So here is an illustration of the level of the agreement obtained for the dispersion relations. So this graph here contains over 550 independent dispersion points along different directions, two fields, 5 and 9 tesla from our own data. These are the signed points. And these are obtained by doing scans in energy, fitting them, including the error bar, and so on. And the red points are from 5 tesla previous experiments. Here, there's larger error bars because we get these centers from, you know, point clicking on a color picture. So just to illustrate the level of the agreement that can be obtained and the strong coupling between the parameters, here is our parameterization here, where we refine all 6 parameters. And here is the previous parameterization, which assumed a certain ratio for the G factors. Now, the main difference between our parameterization and the previous result is really in the value of the Ising coupling JZZ, where we find to be negligible, whereas it was quite substantial in the previous case. However, if you look at the theoretical prediction for these two quite different Hamiltonians, if you like, they are extremely similar to the point that differences are only of minute details, okay? And almost indistinguishable from the experimental data. So just at the level of this data alone, without fixing the G-tensor ratio, it's not possible to distinguish between the two models. However, if we use additional data with field along cubic axis, there are important differences, so we can distinguish between the two models. In particular, this lower row of panels here shows predictions of the previous model, and you see the white points are extracted dispersion points from the experimental data, and there are significant differences between the observed dispersion and the prediction. There are gaps that are seen experimentally that are not accounted for the model, and so on. So we believe that this difference is significant because it's a difference in behavior for the center of mass of the scattering. So it's not just a small detail, but actually the large part of the scattering is significantly shifted in the experiment compared to the theoretical model. So if we use our parameterization, then we can explain essentially all the data, both from the previous experiment and the current one. So you see the strong modes are strong, the weak mean modes are weak, the gaps as seen in the experiment are well accounted for, and also where the theoretical prediction where modes cross doesn't give a large splitting, that's exactly what's seen in the experiment. And so this is a very extensive data set looking at 17 directions in reciprocal space, and everywhere where we look, there's very good agreement. So here is another illustration of the type of agreement that we can obtain. So on the vertical axis here is the term JZ plus minus, which we find to be the dominant term, and we agree in magnitude with the previous parameterization, whereas the horizontal axis will be the Ising coupling. So, and this plot shows the chi-squared by fitting to all the data. And there's a global minimum where this current parameterization lies, whereas a previous parameterization is somewhat far away and quite distinguishable in chi-squared. So using this extensive data set, we're able to distinguish between these And we're confident that our parameterization can explain essentially all the experimental data that's published, which allows for quantitative parameterization. So also the refined g-factor is essentially within error bar the same as the most recent determination of the crystal field levels. This was really, this comparison was done after we did all the fits. So you know, we weren't really influenced by this. Also these exchange parameters agree with parameterization of the diffuse scattering at somewhat finite temperature by Roberts et al. And also this agrees with the energies and field dependence of terahertz excitations observed at the zone center, not only in the energies but also the polarizations of the modes. There were some discrepancies with this previous parameterization.
Actually, can I ask a question just while you're on this? So the ratio of the G tensors is the same, but the magnitude is a little bit different, right?
That's right, yeah.
And so what does that translate into just a scale factor for all the exchange constants together? Or how
so, okay. I think we can distinguish between this because the absolute scale of the magnetization is fixed. Well, fixes the absolute scale of the g-tensor. So if we were to use different g-factors, this point wouldn't fit.
So can you comment on the work we had done with Rajiv, for example, using Ross's parameters, where we had measured or computed the magnetization temperature and field dependence, where there should be no adjustable parameters left after their work?
Do it for this. I think here we're sensitive to the fine details, you know, in momentum space and so on. So,
but I think that is a good suggestion, Michelle. You could do it for their parameters.
I'm not sure that's a sufficiently sensitive. If you didn't know what the Hamiltonian was, doing that type of analysis, I'm not sure it gives you a unique solution.
But it is a good consistency check.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm also a bit confused about the comments you make about the consistency with Robert. Diffuse scattering, that's zero field.
Uh-huh.
At 0.4 Kelvin. So I forget now what method did they use to...
So they used some Monte Carlo method to look at features in the diffuse scattering.
So then, presumably, the time to diffuse scattering is could be computed to which I listen and compare in the regime where the...
Oh, these exchange parameters are very similar to that. So essentially that comparison's been done. Okay, so you may ask, well, with these, where does this new Hamiltonian sit into the parameter space? For the pyroclore system, at least at the mean field level. And a mean field calculation puts the system inside the counted ferromagnetic phase as seen experimentally, however, very close, almost on the phase boundary, with phases with antiferromagnetic ordering, this psi 2 and psi 3. So here I'm using a phase diagram where if we have the nearest neighbor exchange determined by four parameters, then essentially there's three independent ratios, and these define a volume in 3D space, and we're taking a plane through this, which goes through the classical spin ice point, the red point here, this blue point, which is the meeting point of three phases, the splayed ferromagnetic phase, these antiferromagnetic XY phases, and also a parametochor antiferromagnet, and also the parameters of E-turbine titanate, all scaled to be normalized to ratios. Okay. So what this phase diagram shows is that the E-turbine titanate actually sits quite far away in parameter space from the classical spin ice point. One may have expected that because the JZZ in our parameterization is very small. But also, this phase diagram highlights the fact that this color grading here is associated with the equilibrium direction of the effective spin away from the local 111 axis. So white indicates that spins are in equilibrium along the 1-1-1 direction. Now, the classical spin ice point sits inside the region of the split ferromagnet because 2 in, 2 out for all the tetrahedra is actually one of the allowed spin ice states. But in fact, along this dashed line, not only the spins are in equilibrium along the local 1-1-1 axis, but actually the classical spin ice degeneracy is preserved. Of course, here the Hamiltonian has quantum terms, but at the classical level, this degeneracy is preserved. So one may think that sort of quantum spin ice physics may be relevant in the close region around this dashed line. It seems that the turbotitanate is somewhat further away from this, and probably the proximity to the phase boundary between ferromagnetism and antiferromagnetism may be more relevant to understand the physics. So if I may move on now, so as I mentioned, the main motivation for us was to determine how the spectrum evolves as a function of field. Now, I showed measurements at very high field here, where we focus with very high resolution on the low energy spectrum and show 4 magnon modes here. However, if we look at high energies, there's also an additional broad continuum magnetic signal that appears only at high fields, as we see, disappears at low fields. This is the true non-magnetic background. And this magnetic signal appears at twice the 1 magnon energies, increases as we lower the field, and also the boundaries move at twice the rate for 1 magnons. So this is qualitatively identified with 2 magnon excitation continuum. So the way to think about this is that in a system that doesn't have rotational symmetry around the field, the magnetization is not a conserved quantity, and in fact, polarization is reached only asymptotically. So there are zero-point fluctuations at any field, so in a quantization basis, some spins are flipped away from the main direction, and then so a neutron can scatter by unflipping a spin and flipping another one, and that's a two-particle excitation, and that increases in intensity as we lower the field, as the magnetization is reduced and zero-point fluctuations increase. So something quite interesting happens now at intermediate fields, because these having finite bandwidth, there's a region at intermediate fields where the 2 magnon continuum is in very close proximity to the 1 magnon excitations. And so mixing and decay and renormalizations can happen. And indeed, we see very strong effects. In particular here, 3 tesla is still above the meeting point. There's 4 sharp magnon modes, and that's the continuum scattering. At 2 tesla, the continuum has essentially eaten up magnon number 4. And then going to lower fields, 1.5 tesla, the continuum comes down in energy and increases in intensity, and the lower 3 magnon modes are squeezed, indicating that their dispersion, or the kinetic energy associated from hopping, is largely suppressed by the proximity of this continuum scattering due to fluctuations, which now has comparable energy to 1 magnon states. So this illustrates already, sort of empirically, that there is very strong coupling between one spin flip and multiple spin flip states, even when overlap doesn't happen. There's very strong mixing. If we go to even lower field, that's 0.75, you see all of the original 3 magnon modes are actually squeezed into a single, almost dispersionless mode, suggesting that the magnon is now local. So you flip the spin, but it doesn't hop. It sort of stays more local. So, and upon further lowering the field, the continuum scattering comes down, gains in intensity, and at zero field, it really dominates the scattering. That's very different from a sort of non-interacting spin wave picture that doesn't capture all of this quantum fluctuation physics. So again, to summarize, a high field, we can explain very well all the magnon eigenstates, dispersions, gaps, what have you. At very low field, instead of this strongly dispersive mode, we see this very broad, dominant scattering continuum. So briefly, here are specific heat measurements where the blue peak is the response at zero field, indicating the transition to the counted ferromagnetic phase. But then if we apply relatively very small fields, you see 50 millitesla, 100 millitesla, this anomaly is suppressed very rapidly, but it stays at the same temperature. So very importantly, it doesn't move to lower temperatures, but it stays there and it's suppressed. So in a phase diagram plot, we have transitions up to some field here and then nothing. So this appears very surprising, however, it can be naturally understood by taking into account the fact that the transition is to a counted ferromagnetic phase, which only breaks the symmetry for the net polarization direction along one of the six cubic axes. So once we apply a field, we've essentially, there's no need for a phase transition because we've broken symmetry already. And if the transition was continuous, one would expect that to be an isolated point. But for first order, there could still be a jump in magnetization up to some finite region, and that's consistent with these measurements here. Also, what's seen in the experiment is that in addition to suppressing this, there's a buildup of scattering weight at some finite temperature, and this maximum shifts to higher temperatures upon increasing field. So that's a characteristic behavior of having a gap that increases in field. And indeed, the parameterization with the Schottky anomaly gives us a gap that monotonically increases in field, as expected in the case of no phase transition, but just all the states being lifted up in field. So to summarize, for field along a cubic axis, we see a crossover between the counted ferromagnetic phase and field polarized. The gap grows monotonically in field. We see very strong quantum fluctuation effects, essentially at all fields. At high fields, there's a two-magnon continuum that grows in intensity. When it comes proximate to the one-magnon state, it mixes with them. It leads to magnon decay, strong renormalization effects. And so, at least at intermediate field, one might expect to capture some of that physics by including one and two magnon states. But in principle, there should be other three magnon continua and so on coming down. So maybe a low field, a more elaborate picture is needed. Then, parameterizing the Hamiltonian from high field, we find a negligible Ising coupling JZZ, but a dominant JZ plus minus, suggesting that actually the Hamiltonian is more quantum than initially anticipated. There are more quantum fluctuations than in a system that's weakly perturbed from the Ising case. And potentially this proximity to the phase boundary is the relevant physics. Just wanted to point out that in this parameterization, if we now go to the cubic axes, there are two dominant terms. There's the J2 and J3. And quite interesting, the model with J2 actually predicts that for every bond, the dominant coupling is an Ising exchange perpendicular to the plane of that bond. But because of the threefold axis, this exchange changes between x, y, z for the three bonds that come out of each vertex. And this is exactly the Kitaev model for the pyrochlor lattice. So it's strongly frustrated because if we have spins along z, then the blue bonds count these energies, but the red and green create quantum dynamics. So this quantum dynamics is on the same scale as the mean field terms. Furthermore, the other anisotropic exchange coupling the other two components also creates dynamics. So the system is intrinsically quantum mechanically, and dynamics also experimentally seems to be an intrinsic part of the physics. There is continuum over an energy scale that's five times the dominant exchange. Thank you very much for your attention.
The very strong coupling between the two magnon continuum and the single magnons, so you would say that's a property of the Hamiltonian. That's a property of the very quantum nature of the Hamiltonian. And in principle, when theorists spend enough time looking at it, they would understand it in those terms. Is that right?
I would think that at least in the regime when there isn't a direct overlap here, but there's still a separation of scale, one could capture some of this physics through doing some interacting model. Whether that's sufficient to describe the zero field, probably not. But already we see that even at the highest fields that we probe, this blue line is the non-interacting spooner model. So already there's work to be done there to understand the two magnon continuum in the limit where that contribution is 2%. Then when you come to here where it's 50%, the discrepancy potentially is even stronger. But certainly, I think that will be very interesting to do that type of calculation and see how much of the physics could be captured that way.
So I looked at the K gamma parameterization myself. So if you just if you only keep K and gamma, so if you only keep J2 and J3 term like this, then so ignoring J1 and J4, then at the classical level you are actually always in the two state, but very close to the phase boundary to ferromagnet.
Yes.
And so so.
Yes, you're here.
You are actually along this line. You are barely in the Poisson three state, so slightly adding small ferromagnet, you need to push it to your ferromagnet. So that's essentially your hamiltonian.
Yes.
And the center point is like a pure gamma model.
Yes.
And this point is actually a pure K model.
The infinite, yeah, when it goes to really.
Yes, And the point is that if you look at the pure gamma model on the particle line, that's actually highly frustrating. Pure K model is also highly frustrating. But the two classical manifolds, they don't overlap, so they're very different. So I mean, I don't have a solution, but
so actually we do for the gamma point.
Oh, you did.
So it's rank two tensor field theory. It looks a little bit like linearized general relativity.
Right, but the question is, do you know the ground state?
It's a spin liquid, classically.
Classically, yeah. So I think that's what I believe.
So quantum, we don't.
Yeah, the classically has to be a classical spin liquid. Yeah. It's a macroscopical design.
Well, it'll be nice to do some, you know, quantitative theory, and I think we have the data to compare if there are predictions there.
So the heat capacity of the ytterbium primate has a secondary maximum at about 3 or 4 Kelvin. And
yes.
Is that beyond what you measured?
Yeah, that's technically not accessible because we lose the dilution fridge around about 800 millik. So we haven't employed all the right tricks to able to do that. Yeah, potentially something interesting.
One more question.
So your mean field ground state, basically it's really close to this plate and ferromagnet phase, yes? But for me it's still very difficult to reconcile because your zero field excitation really shows only continuum excitations, no really any well defined spin wave branches or any gaps. So how would you comment about it?
So so we've heard at the HFM meeting last year that in experiments done in another scattering plane, not the one that we focused on, very close to the 111 Bragg peak, there is a soft magnon mode. But however, that's only present, that has a tiny gap, you know, 40 microelectron volts, and that's only stable up to twice that gap, and the continuum is above it. So in our scattering plane, we were away from these brackets. We didn't do the right experiment to look at that. So I think the surprising experimental fact is that there are very large regions of reciprocals where magnons are not there. But if there is ordering and if it's spontaneous, I think the general expectation is that there would be some soft mode around that, potentially gapped. But we already see that whenever one and two magnon states overlap, the one magnon decays instantly. So we've seen that in in our experiments coming from high field here. So I would say that would be consistent with the magnon being sharp and well-defined only when it doesn't have anything to decay into.
I think for the interest of time, maybe we move to the next topic.